Hello, you are listening to Messing with Herbs with Monica Rood and Nava Konigsberg. This program called Messing with Herbs is all about herbs, medicinal, culinary, how to grow them, how to use them, gardening, food, and health topics. We're going to be talking to you for about an hour once a week on various aspects of herbs. Today, hi Nava.
Hi Monica, how are you?
Good. Today we wanted to talk primarily about what's going on in the garden because it's the end of the season, it's almost the frost, and there's really a lot of loose ends to be taken care of at the end of the season. Actually, a lot of exciting herb stuff going on. So, Nava, do you want to start? What's going on in your garden?
Well, you know, this to me is one of my favorite times to be in the garden. I mean, the spring is always great because you're planting things and fantasizing about stuff. But what I like right at this time of year is, first of all, it's cooler. So it's much more pleasant to work in the garden. And the window of time when it's nice to be out there is a little bigger. And there's just that a little bit of that sense of urgency. You know, frost is going to be coming up probably within the month. And so all of those things that I've been putting off harvesting, I need to get on it with. And it's also time to start thinking about what my late fall and winter garden is going to look like. So it's a pretty busy time in the garden for me right now.
So what are you doing specifically that's like end of the season, starting next season?
Well, it's been getting colder at night, and so my cucumbers haven't been that happy. And, you know, before I get into this, I just want to say that at least in this area, and we've talked about this before, microclimate is so important. And, you know, I live in town. I live in a certain pocket that has certain patterns of heat and cold and frost, and somebody else right down the street from me might be having a really different experience, and certainly people living in some of the outlying areas. So always observe your garden and see what's actually going on. And anything that we say on this show is just a general guide, but the timing may be really different for people. I know out at your place, it's really different. So for me, my cucumbers started getting a little unhappy with the coldness at night. And so I decided to pull them, and I had planted them in cold frames just because I needed the space, and now I want the cold frame back. Cold frame is like a little mini greenhouse that is usually unheated, and you use it for smaller plants to get through the winter, greens and stuff like that. So I've pulled out my cucumbers and dug it up a little bit and added some more compost, and I've started replanting with spinach and lettuce in there. I also started a new batch of beets to keep those going, and I'm going to be starting some more greens once the other things I have in the bed get out of the way.
So other greens could be collards?
Collards, kale, chard.
Mustards,
spinach, lettuce, all kinds of lettuce mixes. Mm-hmm. The Chinese cabbages, which are always fun, like bok choy and stuff like that. I have some green, you know, I have some already that are getting pretty big and that will probably be happy through the winter too, but sometimes they can get bitter, and so it's nice to kind of start some new ones too and just have them be staggered.
Also, the cold weather makes some of those greens taste better, like especially kale. Right. It's famous for having improved flavor after a frost.
Yeah.
I live in Gila, and the frost will probably be probably in 2 or 3 weeks from now, I think. And we usually have a frost earlier than most places in Silver City. So you might not have a frost until into November.
Yeah. And even when we do get one, the first ones will probably be pretty light. And you can get through a frost often by just basically, you know, you can throw a sheet over things. They do sell products. They sell frost covers. You can get it various gardening supply places, and at the end of the show we'll talk about some of those, and we'll also have some available on our website if you're trying to find resources. But there are all different weights of frost cover, and you always have to choose if you get something that gives you more frost protection and keeps your plants going to a lower temperature, then it's going to cut out more sunlight. And so these are not without needing a certain amount of attention. You know, you have to get up in the morning and go out and uncover your plants and recover them and make sure they're getting enough sun and covered up at night. But it does seem to be worth it. And of course, choosing the right plants, choosing to plant things that are going to be a little hardier and a little more happy through the winter months. We also just a couple of weeks ago planted another batch of peas. And so they're doing really well. They're really happy with this cooler weather. They, you know, we did an early batch in the spring, and then through the heat of the summer, you just let them go. And now we've got another batch of peas going. So hopefully we'll have peas for Thanksgiving.
And so the peas won't freeze.
We'll see. I don't think so. And again, we can just throw, if it seems like it's going to be a real hard frost, we'll just throw a little.
So you have to keep an eye on the temperature in the evening as it gets cooler. And if it looks like there's going to be a frost, then you run out and throw a sheet over the things you're concerned about.
And, you know, you can listen to the radio. You can look on the news and see if a frost is predicted. But really, I think the best way to get a sense of when the frost is coming is ask some of the old-timers who can tell. You know, we've talked about the moon and how the moon affects the frost. And that.
Right. Quite often the full moon brings in cold weather or a frost. And since we just had a full moon right at the end of September, there's a good chance the frost won't be until the end of October. But like I said, it's different in Gila than it is in Silver City, and there's a lot of variation. For me, one of the exciting things right now is to plant cover crops. And cover crops are usually planted in the late summer, early fall. It's good to plant them to give them a chance to grow a little bit and get some roots developed before the actual frost comes, and then they will continue to grow during the winter and spring and usually get turned under in the spring. And the reason to plant cover crops, there are many reasons. One is to actually take advantage of this time when nothing much is going on in the garden to grow something that to improve the soil. So cover crops can be just one crop, or it can be a mixture of several things. Often it's legumes and vetch and those kinds of things that have tendrils that are helped by growing up something. So they're often grown with grains like rye or oats. So they, in the spring when they're flowering, they attract beneficial insects to the garden, which then pollinate other things. They greatly improve the nitrogen, the bulk, the organic matter in the soil. Generally, they're turned under in the spring, and then the regular crop is planted. So by using a cover crop during the winter, the bed will be fluffy and have a lot more nutrients in it if it's had a cover crop growing in it. And there are many different kinds of cover crops that can be grown for different reasons, like adding more nitrogen or more organic matter or loosening the soil, loosening the subsoil, et cetera, et cetera. And there are different crops that are better for different parts of the country, depending on how much water you have and if your soil is sandy, et cetera. So a good place to learn more about that is at Peaceful Valley Farms is a place in California. So in their catalog and on their website, they have a lot of information about cover crops and which ones to use depending on what your purpose is. So
the general rule of thumb is that the legumes, which are things that are related to peas and beans and things like that, what they do is really pretty neat because they take nitrogen that's in the soil that's bound up in a way that may not be available to other plants to use. And they take it up into their bodies, and it's transformed there so that then when you take that same plant and chop it up in the spring and put it back into the soil, now that nitrogen is released back into the soil in a form that those plants can use.
That's right.
Which is a really useful thing. And there's lots of plants, you know, peas are legumes. There are the trees that are legumes. You can plant a legume tree. That's what they do, is they're improving the nutrient availability, the food that's available to the plants. Things like grasses, one of the great things that they do is they crowd out weeds. So if you're having a really bad weed problem, and when we say grasses and grains, that's sort of the same thing, because grain crops are grass crops.
Right.
And so what they do is they supply a foundation for the legumes to grow on. They supply a lot of bulk material that gets put back into the soil, and they also help keep weeds down. So it's a really nice combination to do some of both. And some of those crops are really useful, like oats. You know, if we plant oats in the winter and the spring, and we'll talk about this in the spring, we harvest the green tops as they're forming, and we use those medicinally while still leaving the bulk of the plant product available to get turned back into the soil again.
Right. So oats is another thing that's good to plant at this time, or even as late as December, and then they'll be ready to harvest next spring, early summer, and you can get several cuttings of oats, actually. And oats are very calming to the nervous system and actually nutritive to the nervous system. So it's a really good thing to put in your tea to help you stay cool and calm. So cover crops are usually just kind of dug into the soil and then planted, watered regularly until they sprout, and then you'll have a green crop in your garden all winter. It also helps to protect bare soil. And nature doesn't really like to have bare soil. For one thing, bare soil allows a lot of nitrogen in the soil to be released. So keeping it covered either with mulch or a cover crop or both is one way to keep that nitrogen you already have in your soil in there. You can also mulch your perennials and some of your other crops during the winter to help protect them from frost damage and reduce the amount of watering that's needed. And who knows, maybe we'll get water this winter.
That would be nice.
So let's see, what else is going on? Seed saving is a big activity right now. One thing I'm harvesting in my garden is echinacea seeds. So the flowers have gone to seed and they're still on top of the plants, and they're these gnarly, prickly cones. Actually, one of the names for echinacea is coneflower. And the best way to save those seeds is to go around and clip them off and put them in a brown paper bag in a warm place and just let them finish drying. And then after they're dry, I usually wear gloves and rub them against a hard screen, and the seeds usually just fall out. And then you can use a fan to winnow them and actually get all the chaff out, and then you're left with just the nice echinacea seeds.
And do they need anything? Do they need to be chilled during the winter or anything like that to sprout?
It depends on the variety of echinacea. First of all, I want to say that some of the echinacea that are available are bred primarily for ornamental purposes. Like one is called White Swan. It's not as medicinal as some of the others. So the ones Echinacea purpurea, Echinacea angustifolia, and some of those are the ones you want to grow if you want to use them for medicine. They're still beautiful, but they're not quite as spectacular as the White Swan. So you can save the seeds of any of them, but the medicinal ones are primarily Echinacea purpurea and angustifolia. And they do benefit from having some special treatment if you want to germinate them. Usually they're germinated in the spring. You can just let your echinacea go to seed and let the seeds fall on the ground, and they can kind of reseed themselves that way. That's kind of the guerrilla gardener's way of getting more echinacea plants. But if you have the seeds that you've had stored, cold conditioning them is a method of just putting them in moist soil or compost or peat moss in a little baggie in the refrigerator. The Echinacea purpurea needs to be kept in there for about 30 days, and the angustifolia usually for 2 months. And then you take them out and just plant them as usual. Just sprinkle that dirt over the surface of your flat or whatever soil you're planting into, and you'll get good germination from that treatment.
Great. So that sounds really neat. I'm going to go gather my echinacea seeds when we're done.
All right, we're going to take a break right now, and we will be right back. We are back. You are listening to Messin' with Herbs with Nava and Monica.
So, Monica, you were mentioning when you were talking about the echinacea that they're some of the more ornamental varieties and that they're not as medicinal as the original varieties. And that brings up an important point, because that is the case often with medicinal plants, that they have, you know, maybe had a flower, and it is the natural desire of breeders to try to continually improve on their plants by making a more beautiful flower or something that's hardier or does better in a different zone than the one it was originally in. And all that's great. I mean, that's part of our relationship with plants, is that we breed them and we continually help them to, you know, unfold in all their glory. And yet the problem is that when you breed for one trait, something's got to fall off the back of the wagon. And so you don't necessarily know what that's going to be. And oftentimes it can be the medicinal properties of the plant. So it's really important, if you're trying to grow plants for medicine, you can have a beautiful flower garden. I mean, if you go out in my yard, I have primarily medicinal plants out there, and they're beautiful and flowering, but you want to make sure that you get the varieties and the species that are the original ones and that are the medicinal ones. And sometimes it's hard to know. If you're looking through a catalog and it says VAR at the end of the name, that usually means variety, and that means that it's a plant that someone took and specifically bred in order to change it somehow for some trait that they wanted, and so that you know it's been manipulated.
Yes, and sometimes if it says TM after the name of the plant, that stands for trademark, and it means that it's been manipulated.
And so, you know, how do you know if you're getting the right plant? Well, if it's, you know, one great way is to really try to conscientiously shop from nurseries who specialize in native plants and who know. And even if they also are carrying plants that have been bred to be ornamental, a good native plant dealer will also know which is the original plant. And you still get beautiful flowers off of them. So it's just something to be careful of. An example I was thinking of is yarrow. They've come up with all these different beautiful varieties of yarrow in bright yellows with big flowers and pinks and purples and all sorts of things that are beautiful and great in the landscaping. But the original white-flowered yarrow is the native plant and is the one that is medicinal, and that's the one that you want to look for. So,
right, and catalogs often tell you if they're medicinal. Hopefully. And usually you can believe that, depending on who it is. So another thing we're doing at this time of year besides saving seeds is saving tomato seeds.
Oh, those are fun.
Yes, it's really fun. I like doing tomato seeds. There's various ways to do it, but the one I like best is called what we call the wet process. And you basically just take tomatoes that you like. Just, you have to keep the varieties separate, unless you just want to have a mixture of different seeds. And just kind of mush them up and put them in a jar, the whole tomato. If it's a real meaty kind of tomato, then I just squeeze the seeds out. But you can, if it's a small, like a cherry or a yellow pear tomato, you can just put the whole one in there and mush it up and put it on a jar with a lid on it on the windowsill. And you don't have to add water because there's plenty of water in the tomato already. I usually put a tag on it with the name of the tomato and the date that I started it. And I let it sit there for 3 days before I proceed to deal with it. And what happens during those 3 days is the tomato will ferment. And that fermentation process is important because it kills off fungus and molds and bacteria that otherwise might destroy the seed while it's in storage or after you plant it in the spring. It's in place of that pink powder that seed companies sometimes put on seeds, treated seeds.
The other thing that it does is that the gel that surrounds each seed actually contains a germination inhibiting enzyme that basically is what keeps the seed. If you think about it, there's this little tomato seed in this wet tomato. Right. Why doesn't it just germinate? Well, it doesn't just germinate out of the tomato because of these things that are keeping it from doing that. And so that fermentation process also destroys that.
Right.
And if you ever try just straight drying tomatoes, you end up with this sort of gooey stuff all over them, and they're harder to germinate. And so this method, you know, I first started saving seeds from tomatoes because I was working for Plants of the Southwest, and I was growing seed tomatoes for them, and all they wanted was the seed. So I would cut open the tomatoes. I got paid to sit there and split open tomatoes and squish the seeds out and ferment the seeds. And I didn't have to do anything with the tomatoes themselves. So I put them in Ziploc bags and I stuck them in freezers all over town. And in the fall, I canned tomatoes for the first time. And so I learned how to save seeds and learned how to can tomatoes at the same time.
Cool. Okay, so after they've been sitting there for 3 days, then I open the jar and then add water and shake it up. And the skin and the meaty part of the tomato will have separated from the seeds. And so the seeds settle to the bottom and all the little debris floats on top and you can just pour that off. I usually pour it off into a compost bucket, preferably not down the sink. And then you add more water and shake it up and keep pouring it off. And the skin and all that debris, again, will float to the top. And you just keep pouring that off until you just have these little seeds at the bottom. And they're like gold. They're really beautiful. And then I spread them on a window screen to dry. I try not to use paper towels because the seeds stick to the paper towels. And they're really hard to get off after they're dried. So I just spread them out on a window screen out of direct sun in a place where it's warm and there's good ventilation, and label them and go check them every day and stir them up until they're totally dried, and then put them in a little package and always label with the name and the year and any other details, like if you got the tomato from a friend, etc. And that's basically it. I store the seeds in a dry, cool place until ready to start them in the spring.
And I have to just chime in and say that labeling is one of the most important things you will do, both as a gardener and as an herbalist. I can't say how many times I've put something in a bag and said, oh, I'll know what that is. And after a few months, it all looks and smells like old oregano that's lost its smell anyway. And label, label, label. Invest in some Sharpies and some tape, whatever it takes, but always make sure that you keep good records. That's going to, because otherwise you won't know what you're planting next year.
Yeah, I agree. Labeling is essential.
So in addition to the tomato seeds, I'm also doing sort of my last rounds of gathering my herbs. I've got some lemon balm that I've been cutting over the winter. I'm going to do a last cut on that. I've got catnip that I'm deciding. Am I going to let it go to seed and expand and reseed, or I'm going to do another harvest of it? And the weather is perfect right now. I know we'd all love some more rain, but right now it's dry and beautiful, and it's a great time for drying herbs. And so that's what I'm going to be working on over the next few days. I've got the last of the basil, and it may not be the last, but you know, don't take chances. I'm gonna be cutting basil and lemon balm and thyme and sage. And, you know, it's always a balance because the plants that are perennials need some leaves on them in order to have some energy to send into the ground to get them through the winter. So you don't want to just denude them.
But that's an important point. Do not cut your herbs right down level with the ground. Leave some plant with some leaves on it to give it some winter protection.
Yeah.
And then I mulch around them too.
Mm-hmm. And certain herbs, like sage, for example, if you don't cut it back to some degree, you're just going to end up with really woody, hard plant next year that won't give you as many leaves. But some of those I'll cut, some of them I'll let die back naturally. Again, they'll just sort of reabsorb some of their nutrients and keep themselves going. And then over the winter, I'll cut back the woody part.
Well, I usually prune mine in the spring, like February or so. I leave all that foliage on there because I think it does give them some winter protection.
For sure.
So, yeah, it's really great to dry your own herbs to have to cook with in the winter and to make tea. And I dry echinacea flowers, and if I am coming down with a cold, I put an echinacea flower in my tea, and I think it's really, really good medicine and easy.
I really encourage people to try to dry their own culinary herbs. In particular, culinary herbs that are sold in the supermarkets are often not only non-organic and sprayed with pesticides, they're often irradiated when they're brought in from other countries. They're treated with radiation. Often a lot of them are old, and the smells that you get and the flavors that you get from freshly dried herbs is absolutely heavenly. You'll notice that all of a sudden your food starts tasting better when you're using fresher, and when I say fresh, I mean freshly dried herbs. It's absolutely magnificent. A lot of herbs lose their flavor pretty quickly, especially things that are very strong smelling to start with. The reason they smell so strongly is because all those little molecules that contain the smell are evaporating in the air and hitting your nose. That's why you smell them so strongly. And so they're just going to keep evaporating. And here in the Southwest, we are really lucky. It's pretty easy to dry stuff. Again, you want to keep things out of direct sunlight. You want good ventilation, but an old window screen or even an open basket. Sometimes for some things, I'll just take an open basket and put a little paper towel down on it and put the herbs on there and let them dry. You do want to keep track of them. If it seems like it's going to rain, you don't want to have a situation where a plant dries out and then it gets rainy and damp out and there's moisture in the air and the plant reabsorbs moisture from the air. That degrades the quality of the plant, even if you dry it back out again. So at the moment that it's dry enough, and you do want to be sure it's totally dry.
Crispy.
Mm-hmm, before you start storing it, because you don't want it to get moldy. But the moment it's dry, you want to store it. And ideally, especially with these highly aromatic plants, you don't want to crumble them all up really small before you store them. You want to keep them as intact as you can until you're ready to use them, because the more surface area of the plant that's exposed to the air, the more of those good flavor and smell molecules you're going to lose. So, you know, cut the plants, lay them out to dry, and then put them in. I always store everything in glass jars.
Hold that thought. Let's take a little break and we'll come back and talk about storing herbs in just a moment. Here we are back again. You are listening to Messing with Herbs with Monica and Nava. And we were talking about storing dried herbs. You were saying something about how you store them.
Well, so I don't like storing herbs in plastic. Yes. I don't really like storing many things in plastic. That's a whole other conversation. But aside from whatever concerns we may have about plastic, it just doesn't keep the aromatics
smell
in.
Yeah.
And so if you can smell something through a container that you're storing it in, then it is degrading. It is losing its mojo as you go. And glass is a super way to store stuff. So I like to store my herbs in glass, out of the sun, you know, in a dark space. They do not need to be refrigerated. And the rule with those, again, those highly aromatic herbs, things like mints, things like lemon balm, things like sage,
oregano,
and thyme and oregano, is if they smell good, they are good. And if they don't have any smell, then they're not going to give you any flavor in your food. And so it's not rocket science. You don't have to sit there and wonder, you know, is this still good? You'll know. You'll smell it. It'll still have a good color. It'll still, you know, the color will be similar to whatever it was when you dried it. For the most part, if an herb is brown when you dry it, then something went wrong. There's a few exceptions to that.
It should be green.
It should be green. It should be dark green when you dry it.
Well, what I would say is glass is nice. Those tins that seal tightly is a really good way to store herbs. I've had peppermint stored in one of those tins that still smelled good years later, to my surprise. Also, if you must store it in plastic, I tell people to use freezer bags because it's a thicker plastic, mm-hmm, and it will keep more of the scent in. But generally, cheap little plastic bags with a twist tie on it and no label that are thrown in the back of the cabinet, and the cabinet is above the stove where you cook, where there's heat and moisture all the time, that's the worst possible thing you can do with herbs. So don't do that. Keep them in a dry, cool place away from the stove. And like you were saying, if they smell good, they're still good. But generally, every year or so, it's a good idea to replace them with fresh ones and advance those to the compost pile.
And that goes along with what we were talking before about labeling. You know, always label your containers of dried herbs. And I've even started putting a little date on my herbs in my spice rack so that I know when I put it in, and I try to make sure that every year I replace them. And that's when I notice the ones that I don't tend to use. And then maybe I want to make that space available for another herb, another spice that I maybe will use more often.
And we usually don't think they're as old as they are. It's like, oh, these are from last year. And then you look at the day and it says 2008. And it's like, oh, wow, time flies.
It does.
This is also a good time of year to plant some seeds, such as chamomile, flax, and larkspur are three that I have found really like to get their seeds out there during the winter so that they can germinate whenever they want, whenever is right for them, which is never when I get around to it. When I get around to throwing those things out is sometime in March. But if those seeds get just sprinkled wherever you want them, you don't have to cover them up, just sprinkle them wherever you want them, and the seeds are pretty smart. They can figure out for themselves when to come up, but they like to get germinated when it's cold. As a matter of fact, I already have some larkspur coming up in my garden. That's the earliest one. But chamomile and flax are ones that also really like to get started when it's cold. So larkspur, if you're not familiar with it, is not a good herb to take internally. It's actually toxic. It's in the same family with delphiniums. But larkspur is really good for lice.
Yes, well, we've been, and you know, here we are back to school. The kids are all together again. And you wouldn't think that this would be the time of year, but we've already had at least one local school have a lice infestation. And you can make an anti-lice oil. I make a lice shampoo. But you can also make a simple lice oil by gathering the, you sort of want to blend. You want some of the green seed pods. Larkspur makes a really pretty flower. It propagates really easily. It spreads really easily. It's sort of this purples and pinks and whites flower. But if you, and they don't all bloom at the same time. So it's really hard to get a really consistent plant to harvest. But if you harvest it when there's some green and some flower and some that have gone past flower, and you just sort of cut those tops off and you let them dry for a few days and chop them up and cover them with some olive oil and let them steep for a couple of weeks in a warm place and then strain it out, and then you've got this oil. Now, again, as you mentioned, Monica, this is not something you want to take internally, but the toxicity that it contains works to our benefit for lice. And so then you sort of slather your hair with this oil and leave it on for a while, and it suffocates them and kills them. And then you can follow that up with either an herbal anti-lice shampoo. The one that I make also does have larkspur. I make an extract, an alcohol extract with larkspur, and I mix that with other things to make the shampoo. And it can be really effective. And although it's toxic to the lice, it's not nearly as toxic as a lot of those products that are out there.
Now, is that something you should repeat? Do you need to do it again in a few days?
Yeah, the same. Yes, you do, because you want to, the nits, the little eggs, have a cycle. And as long as we're talking about lice, I was a preschool teacher for 5 years, and I am actually, you probably don't know this about me, but I am a master nit picker.
Oh, my God.
I have picked nits out of hair for years. We would get lice every year at the daycare center I worked at. And one of the things you can do to protect your children if they're going to a school where there has been a lice outbreak is put a bandana on their heads and put a few drops of lavender oil on the bandana, and the lavender oil will help repel them. Huh. And you know, there's a lot of myths about lice. They tend to actually prefer clean hair to dirty hair, to oily hair, because the oil in the hair makes it harder for them to hold on. They also tend, and again, there's always exceptions to this, but they tend to prefer straight hair to curly hair, because curly hair, if you ever curl ribbon, right? And the way you curl ribbon is you straighten it, right? You run a scissor or something along it. And so a curly hair, if you look at the cross ways of that hair shaft, it's actually flat. Whereas a straight hair is round in cross-section. And that round is more is easier for them to sort of get around and attach their egg onto.
Huh.
And
I had no idea.
Yeah. So have curly, greasy hair, use larkspur and lavender, and you should be okay.
Wow. Well, you heard it here first, folks, that straight hair is round and curly hair is flat. All right. Cool. Well, another thing I wanted to talk about today on Messing with Herbs is food. One of the things I like to do is make soup, because soup is easy to make. It's very nourishing. You can put anything in the world just about in soup. And it's really great for people who have very busy schedules and don't have time to cook. You just throw a bunch of stuff in the pot and eat it, and it's good leftover, and it's just an amazing food. And so the soup I wanted to talk about today requires some convenience foods, but these are not convenience foods that I would recommend going to the store to buy, unless you really have to, but to make them yourself. They're quick to make, and then you have them in the freezer. One of the things I like to do is make up a big batch of greens, cooked greens that are seasoned and already tasting good and can be eaten just by themselves. So I usually get a bunch of collards, one of kale, mustard maybe, whatever your favorite greens are, not lettuce, that doesn't cook so well. Cook the greens up together and then season them with onions and garlic and whatever your favorite way is to make a big pot of greens, and then have some for dinner and put the rest of it in the freezer in whatever size containers works for you. For me, I usually put it in quart containers in the freezer, of course, labeled with what it is and the date. So then I always have greens in there to make a quick meal. And I do the same with chicken stock. When I stew a chicken, I save some of the broth, throw it in there. Sometimes I season it, sometimes I don't. And then beans. If you have beans in there and greens and chicken stock, you can make many meals in a half hour. You just take them out, throw them in a pot, heat them up, and you got dinner. So the recipe I made most recently, which I called Soup of the Day, this recipe is going to be on the webpage for Messing with Herbs that you will find at gmcr.org. So you don't have to madly try to write down all of these ingredients. I sauteed an onion, celery, and some ground turkey in a little oil with some fennel seed and cumin seed. If you don't want to use turkey, you can use other kinds of meat, or you can use firm tofu, or maybe none of the above. It can be just vegetables. Then I added 3 large cloves of crushed garlic and some chopped up red pepper, some tomatoes, and cooked that all together for a few minutes. And then I threw in a quart of cooked greens out of the freezer and a quart of chicken stock. And that was soup. It was ready in about 30 minutes. And I served it with garlic toast that was made with lots of crushed garlic and a little bit of butter, olive oil on whole grain toast. So it was a very nutritious, fast meal. There were some left over for the next day. And so that's what I recommend. Put stuff in the freezer at this time of year when you have a little bit extra. And it's like instant food, and it's better than going to the store and buying all the ingredients already preserved, chemicalized, etc.
It's also, you know, one thing that I know other parents, I'm sure, always deal with is getting kids to eat vegetables. And the more connected they are to the whole process, you know, if they've helped to plant them, helped with the garden, but also the putting up part of it. It can be really fun for kids to measure things out and, you know, put them into different containers. And the more connections that the kids have with the vegetables that are going into the food they eat, then later in the year when you pull that out and you say, oh, remember we planted this, or remember when we put that up, and they're going to be a lot more likely to at least try it than something that just comes from the store that they have no connection to. So get the kids involved in it too. And my final word is label, label, label.
Have the kids label.
Have the kids label.
Have them write the label and put their numbers on there.
And then figure out 3 months later what they wrote. That should be fun.
Right, right. Yes, I think that's a great idea to get your family connected with where your food comes from. Eggs don't come from the store. They don't come from the carton. They come from chickens. So let's go harvest the eggs, or, you know, pick up the eggs, or go visit a chicken farm. So people really do get an idea where their food comes from. And a lot of the local food movement that's going on is a big part of that. You can figure out who is growing your food, and it's not just by magic that it appears on the store shelf. All right, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Messing with Herbs. This is Monica and Nava, where we're talking about herbs, medicinal, culinary, how to grow them, how to use them, gardening, food, and health topics. So what I wanted to talk about next is tea. What is tea? How do you make your own tea? And what are some of the teas that we especially like? First of all, sometimes a tea is called an herbal infusion. Basically, you take a tea bag, you put it in a cup, you boil water, you pour it over the tea bag, you let it steep 5 minutes, and take the tea bag out, and you got a tea. And then you can sweeten it or not, add milk or not. Right, so that's like the basic introduction to how to make tea with a tea bag. But using loose, what we call loose herbs, can you give you a lot more varieties in the herbs that you have to put in tea. And you can kind of customize it to what you want to use it for, depending on if you want it to be calming, promote sleep at bedtime, or if you're coming down with a cold, or if you want to have a tea to promote digestion. And we're going to be talking about all these different ideas on our program, Messing with Herbs. But basically, you're making an herbal infusion. The basic recipe is a teaspoon of whatever herb, in a cup. You can put it in a tea ball or a teaspoon or in a strainer, whatever method you want. Pour hot water over it, let it steep 5-10 minutes or more. The longer you let it steep, the stronger it will be. So you can make it to taste and strain it out, and that's basically what an herbal tea is.
I just want to clarify, there is a plant called tea. And when you buy, you know, Lipton tea in a bag, that's what you're buying, is tea. And green tea and black tea and all the different varieties of tea, oolong and Earl Grey and all of those, are all actually come from the same exact plants, Camellia sinensis. And so it gets confusing. And with the rise of the herbal tea market, what has happened is that people have started calling teas made from any plant other than the tea plant herbal tea, and teas made from the tea plant either black, green, or white tea. And those are not because they're different plants, they're because of the way that they're processed. And at some point we'll have a whole show about tea, because, you know, a fifth of the population of the planet drinks tea in vast quantities, and whole societies have been created around it. But what we're talking about today is herbal teas. And because when you're making a tea, like a, you know, Lipton kind of a tea, really all you're trying to get out of it is the flavor. And that's the first thing that comes out of the plant and into the water when you're making tea. And as any of you know, if you left your tea bag in too long, once those nice flavored things come out, the next things to start coming out are not as pleasant, and you end up with sort of bitter or astringent tea.
From the tannins.
But right. For the most part, when we're making an herbal tea, that is a tea from any plant other than the tea plant, we need to steep it longer. because a lot of the thing, we're not just trying to get a pleasant flavor out of it. Sometimes you are, and that's perfectly legitimate. But if you're trying to make a medicinal tea, you usually want to let it steep for about 15 minutes, average and minimum.
So what are some kinds of medicinal teas you like to make?
Well, I love all kinds of teas, and I'm sure most people, you know, the most common ones that people think of are things like chamomile and mint, which are easy to grow in the garden and easy to make tea out of. And those are ones that don't need a long steeping time. And the mint in particular, you can usually do to taste. One thing to remember about something like mint is I was talking before about when we were talking about drying herbs and how if you can smell it really strongly, then it's all evaporating out. Well, it's the same when you're making tea. When I'm making a particularly a highly aromatic tea, a really smelly tea, good smelly in the good sense, I always try to keep a lid on the tea while it's steeping so that all those good oils and all those good aromatics don't just evaporate into the air and they stay in my teacup and they're there for me when I want to drink them. Both because it will make the tea taste and smell better, and because whatever medicinal properties they have will be kept in the teacup. But what I want to talk about today are things that people don't usually think about as teas. When people start off growing an herb garden, they often grow the really common herbs that we all think of, thyme and basil and oregano and sage and marjoram and tarragon and things like that. And those are really yummy, delicious things that we can put into cooking, but they also make great teas and they're highly medicinal. When I get sick, my favorite tea is a combination of thyme, oregano, and rosemary. And again, it depends how, you know, what type of sickness you have, but that's kind of my base tea, to which I'll add different things depending on what's going on. They all are really high in aromatic oils. They tend to be highly antibacterial, antiviral. They are very stimulating to the circulatory system. So when you're sick and you're kind of got that cold, stuck feeling, it keeps everything moving. It's warming. I'm susceptible to throat problems. I get a lot of sore throats. And so they're wonderful for sore throats. I'll add lemon and honey and cayenne and other things to them. And they are super duper medicinal, and they taste really yummy. And rosemary, I always put in some rosemary because in addition to all of the things I just mentioned, it's also a mood lifter. It's a mood elevator. I wouldn't go so far as to call it an antidepressant, but it certainly can lift your spirits. And when you're feeling sick, giving your emotional body a little boost to me is as important as giving your physical body a little boost, because your body will follow where your spirit goes. And so I think it's always a great idea. I love adding rosemary when someone is sick, to just for because it has all those medicinal properties too, but it also just can really lift the spirits.
Some of my favorites are lemon verbena, lemon thyme, and lemon basil. Mm. Those are all herbs that are easy to grow. Lemon verbena actually is a little tree. And lemony things when you're feeling sick. It cuts through that sore throat and the mucus, and it's a little bit sour. Of course, you can put honey in, but
settles the stomach.
Good for stomach stuff. And you feel like you're doing something good for yourself when you make an herb tea, and especially if it's fresh herbs that you got, you grew in the garden yourself and dried them and have them stored in the cabinet. It's a good way to be good to yourself.
Lemon verbena is one of my absolute favorite herbs. I have one growing in my garden that I actually got from you. All and right. It's not a little tree because I keep cutting on it and it keeps dying back in the wintertime. So it's just sort of a little, it's got a bunch of little individual branches going. It definitely likes some warmth. And so I've got it on the south side of my house against a little stone foundation there. And it comes back every year. And it's quite happy. And there's something about that lemony smell that's just uplifting and cheering.
Well, speaking of warmth, there are a number of herbs that are aromatic that are made more aromatic if they're grown in the sun. That's why the Southwest is such a great place to grow aromatic herbs. Our climate is actually similar to the Mediterranean climate where a lot of these plants originated. But the sun really concentrates those aromatics, which actually are produced by the plant as a way of protecting itself from the sun damage and also from being eaten by animals and insects and such. So if you notice that some of your plants are not very aromatic, take a look at whether they're growing in the sun or the shade. Because I saw a fabulous rosemary once. It was spectacular, but it got a lot of water and a lot of shade, and it had hardly any aromatics to it at all. So the Mediterranean herbs especially benefit from being in full sun. Also, don't overwater aromatic herbs because that dilutes their aromatics. They actually improve their flavor and their aromatics by being stressed a little bit. So I try to put those in a separate area of my garden that gets watered less. I intentionally water them less. Maybe they only need it a couple times a month even. Lavender is another one. Thyme, oregano, marjoram, all those. Don't water too much.
And also don't fertilize.
Oh, yes.
These are all plants, when you think of the Mediterranean soil that they were growing in, it's not very fertile soil. And this is a common mistake that people make, not just with medicinal herbs for their flavors, but in general with trying to grow native plants, that they over-fertilize them, over-water them, over-baby them. And what you end up with are these big plants that look gorgeous, but then, as you mentioned, in the case of medicinal plants, don't have any aromatics. Or in the case of native plants that you're trying to grow, have lost their edge of being drought tolerant. You know, if you over-fertilize them, you get a plant bigger than it should be, it's going to need more water, no matter what kind of a plant it is. So it's really important to learn about the properties and the history of the plants that you're growing, and try as much as possible to match the conditions that they grew under. And it's definitely true, you'll notice that if you overwater plants, they lose their aromatics.
Actually, giving nitrogen to aromatic plants decreases the aromatic oil production.
Because a lot of these are stressed. You know, one thing it's important to remember is plants don't produce the chemicals that they produce for our benefit. They produce them for their own benefits. And we are the lucky receivers of their gifts. But they make them for their own purposes. And often they are made in response to stress, like chilies. You know, chili peppers make capsaicin as a stress response. And so if you don't stress them, they're not going to make the capsaicin. They're not going to be as spicy.
Right. So withholding water and growing them in high heat is what makes the peppers here really different than they would be if they were grown in Oregon.
Don't be too nice to them.
That's right.
Or to your medicinal herbs.
Yeah, don't baby your plants. Yeah. You can baby your lemon verbena, though, because it does okay with water. So that's a good one. And don't be afraid to move your plants around from one place to another. If they're not doing well in one spot, try moving it someplace else. Or if you buy three plants, put them in three different kinds of conditions to experiment and see, does it do better in the shade or do better in a sunny spot? And also, there are so many different varieties of so many herbs, such as oregano. There's Italian oregano and there's Greek oregano and various varieties of oregano within those categories. And like all Greek oreganos don't taste the same. So it's fun to buy a variety of different types and then taste them and grow them for a couple of years and see which ones you really like. And right now I'm getting ready to rip a bunch of Greek oregano out of my garden because it just doesn't have that strong aromatic, even though I stress it as much as I can. It's a beautiful plant, and I think maybe it would be fabulous in someone's garden who isn't going to use it medicinally or even cook with it. They just want a big, fat, beautiful Greek oregano. And I'm going to go back to the gnarly, little, skinny oreganos that taste really fabulous when they're dried. So I think that's it for this week's show. This has been Nava and Monica here, Messing with Herbs on GMCR.org. Please go to the website and visit our page specifically for the Messing with Herbs program, and we'll talk to you next time. In the meantime, be sure and eat your greens.